Off the ball rugby.
I would be very, very low if I was involved in that group who have gone to three finals, because losing in finals is 10 times the hurt.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Football on Off the Ball
with William Hill. Who you got? 18 plus. See gamblingcare.ie.
All right, I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Republic of Ireland international Megan Campbell. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
You're here as a Pepsi ambassador. We were down in the Grand Canal last week ahead of the Europa League final. We've got the Champions League final coming up and, of course, a couple of big matches for yourself. You're keeping well?
Yeah, not too bad. Enjoying the off-season, being back up home in Northern England with family. So it's nice to enjoy a bit of downtime, but obviously still having to train leading into hopefully the camps now. So
yeah,
two big massive games against Sweden and ones that we're needing points from. So we're looking forward to the challenge.
What are you doing with Pepsi?
We had the obviously Europa League final, being a main sponsor. The hidden pitches were around Grafton Street, and it was just an opportunity for fans to come down, or you know, just the general public in general, to be able to come down and experience just playing on the street again, as you used to do probably as a kid growing up.
Did you play on the streets growing up?
Yes, I did, definitely. Used to draw our own goals on the side of people's houses, and when the ball went in the garden, you'd be lucky if you got it back if you had a good neighbour. But yeah, well, I was quite fortunate enough to have a good neighbourhood, good friends around the place, and obviously we were never in off the streets. You'd get the call at 5-6 o'clock, your tea's ready, it's on the table, don't be late. And obviously you'd turn in late, and it was your own fault if it was cold, but yeah.
You didn't mind turning in late?
No, I spent a lot of evenings outside playing football, and yeah, thankfully it's been good to me.
Did you play with girls' team growing up or a boys' team?
I played with boys, yeah, up until under-16s in Drogheda, where I was from. There was no girls' teams, so I had to play with boys, which I definitely think has stood to me now in terms of my physical ability and things like that. So, yeah, you can say that it wasn't probably the best opportunity like it is now for girls to have the opportunity to play with girls growing up. But for me, I also think it stood to me as a player being able to play with the boys, yeah.
Yeah, now that you're a bit older and you're thinking back to that and looking at the way you came through and how younger footballers now are coming through, there's a footballing benefit to playing with boys all the way up, but maybe a mental development that you would have been much happier in certain ways if you were on a girls' team.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, you probably get used to the scrutiny when you're younger a lot quicker. With boys' football, it was, oh, why have you got a girl playing on your team? Or she's no good, you mustn't be any good. Or people laughing on the sidelines, parents thinking, why is there a girl playing for the boys' team? And then when you win or you score or you're winning in cup finals, and they're like, actually, okay, we take that back. And it was nice to silence the critics. Obviously, as a kid, you just want to play football. You just want to enjoy it. And to be hearing things like that on the sideline wasn't sometimes always nice, but the best way to shut it down is to just play well. And I think for me, it made my skin hard growing up. And
I'd imagine so. What club was it?
Played with quite a few down south, well, in Drogheda.
You were in demand, I'd imagine.
Yeah. Growing up, I think I went from Grove Rangers to Boyne Rovers. I played with Moneymore FC and then Drogheda United for a year, but also within girls as well, before moving to Dublin.
What is that like when you're 12, 13 years of age, massively important moments in a young girl's development, and you're going out and you're playing with the boys, and you are hearing those sort of comments on the sideline?
I think for me, it was all about I love the game and I wanted to play football, and I never seen it as any different to me having boys' friends or girls' friends, you know. And so I was just out there playing with my friends, playing football and enjoying it growing up. And I think my mum and dad and my family really kept reiterating that, was like, you're there to enjoy it. And I say that now to the kids when they ask me, like, have I got any like tips and stuff for them growing up? And I'm like, you got to do it with a smile on your face. When you're that age, it's all about enjoying it. It's not about the seriousness behind it. And you do hear those things and the critics I would have heard growing up. But ultimately, as a kid, you don't really hold on to those things, because kids are very good at saying how they think or what they think straight to your face. And I think when you grow up and you're not afraid to hold your tongue and stuff like that, and you just got to play football and enjoy it. And
if any young lad in Drogheda who's thinking back to playing you was the one going, what's the girl doing on your team, would you have been straight over giving them both
100%.
Barrels?
Oh yeah. Or when, maybe in small words, but also in terms of playing ability and things like that. I remember playing with club and then missing out on the starting 11 in terms of cup final and stuff, and I was absolutely gutted. And it came to it, and well, a boy had took my place in the team. And when it came to it, I, I came on the pitch and changed the game, and we ended up, you know, winning the game. So yeah, for me, that was like a massive thing for me, was you can silence them by playing football. And that's just what I stuck to.
Yeah, brilliant. Your coaches must have been pretty important then as well, in that, you know, they obviously knew your talent, and they were obviously comfortable having you on the team, and there probably weren't too many options for girls' teams anyways, but actually making sure you were comfortable in the environment.
Yeah, I think there's too many to name now, but I had a massive amount of managers and coaches that really helped me develop as a young player into what I am now. And I think I've learned a lot of lessons from them, coaches, throughout my career growing up. And yeah, like I said, I'll say it again, I wouldn't be where I am today without those coaches behind me and supporting me. And like you said, giving me the ability to go out and express myself and be a kid and enjoy football.
So did you know then at that age you were a bit different, that your talent was a bit different?
I wouldn't say I knew that my talent was different. I would just, I just loved playing football, and all I thought about was football. I dreamt about football. I had my wall in my bedroom covered in Ireland flags and pennants, and everything I was doing was for football. And I didn't have any other thought in my head about a different job outside of football. After school, I didn't think I want to do anything else. It was just, yeah, football mad. And I think it was also a credit to my mum and dad, because they never held me back or said, no, Meg, you need to be serious about this. Like, this isn't for girls, or, you know, this might not be an opportunity that you can actually follow through with and achieve. And yeah, I think they fully supported me in doing so. And yeah, I wouldn't be where I am without them either.
It is a different world, women's sport, even, what's that, 15, 16, 17 years ago. Yeah, you know, the Megan Campbells of that day are not sitting in radio studios. They're not representing big worldwide brands. Katie McCabe's poster isn't on every corner. It's hard to find your inspiration. So when you're thinking about football as everything to me, did you think these opportunities were going to be there? Did you believe that you could be a full-time professional footballer?
I believed I could, yeah, definitely. I thought, well, I'm going to play at the highest level. I didn't know how I was going to get there, but I definitely believed that I was going to do that. And how the road led me to playing professional football was not something that I thought about. I was just thinking day on day, week on week, enjoying football, and then going to the Gaynor Cup, being selected for a national team underage, and then thinking, wow, this could actually be a possibility. And I think that's at that age when maybe I got selected for the Gaynor Cup team, I thought, I actually could, you know, possibly do this as a career. And I think that's when the seriousness changed in me. And I was like, okay, now my dedication needs to be 100%. And I missed out on quite a lot with my friends growing up through school years and things like that. And they went on to do different careers and are very successful in what they're doing now. But you miss out on those weekends out as a kid growing up.
And did that dedication come easy to you?
Yeah, because all I thought about was football.
Yeah.
So I didn't miss out on anything, because I never had that to miss out on. Because yeah, all I knew was football. So.
You've obviously lived the dream then, in that, you know, getting to represent your country on so many occasions, getting to play at the very highest level of the club game as well. And I presume you're going to say, no, there's no regrets. But when you look at the opportunities that are there now, you know, for somebody, say, in 10 years' time, who'll have played for Manchester City and Liverpool, even financially, they're going to have a very different experience probably to the one you've had, with the way that wages are increasing, that the money is flowing into the game, that if you were a generation later, your life would be probably very different.
Yeah, you could say that in one sense, obviously, if you take it into consideration about the finances and the security, and knowing that those possibilities are there for young girls now 100%, and there's no questions about it. But I think for me, I would never change my route to football. I would never change how I've got to where I am today, because without those experiences and learnings, I wouldn't be who I am as a person, never mind a player. So for me, I definitely wouldn't change like my route. And I'd like to think that, although a very, very small part of it, I could have helped to pave the way for where football is today.
Yeah,
in Ireland, and obviously, yeah, in England too. So yeah, I wouldn't change my route, definitely not.
If I ask you about the throw-ins, do you instantly raise your eyes to heaven?
No, definitely. No. I think I get this question a lot. And for me, it's an asset, a weapon. And if I can help the team, whether that's national team or club team, then I'm going to do so. But I would like to think I am more than just a thrower of a ball that can go quite far. But yeah, it's an asset definitely to have. And it's obviously in the last game gone a bit viral and things like that. And
I don't know how it didn't go viral after the Scotland game, because it's still in the thousands of games of football I've ever seen, the only time I've ever seen a throw-in end up in the back of the net.
I think maybe when you're playing against the European champions and those who have, you know, on the biggest stage in England, so it's always a step above when you're playing against those giants, and I think maybe that's possibly why.
The Scotland game, because I remember at the time actually going, uh-oh, what's the rule here? What's the rule here again? I've never seen this before. Was that the first time that had ever happened, that you'd had a throw-in that had gone all the way through?
No, I remember underage doing it quite a bit when we were kids, but obviously the goals are a lot smaller and you're playing against different levels of players. And then when I was playing for Man City against Chelsea in league, I threw the ball in and it went, the keeper jumped out and it bounced and went under her legs, and we were all claiming that it went in because obviously Man City against Chelsea at that time was title contenders games, and unfortunately it didn't touch her. So the referee wiped it out. But yeah, that was, I'd say the Scotland game was probably the third or fourth time it had happened to me, but the first obviously for Ireland.
Yeah. So when you go back to playing on the streets, is that where it started? Like how when you look at just how bloody good it is and impressive it is to see it live, you wonder like why more people can't throw the ball, never mind properly, but throw at any sort of distance. Like, what is it when you look back that gave you that skill set?
I have no idea, to be truly honest with you. I was playing with the boys with Boyne Rovers and my throw-in was just further than the lads, and they said, do that again. And it just, as I grew up, it got longer, which I'm quite fortunate to have. And I'm hypermobile, so that maybe helps. And
what does that mean?
So basically, my joints are, they extend like further than the normal.
Okay, so there is a reason behind this.
Yeah, I would say it definitely plays a part.
I do have a football here. I know you don't want to get injured. Go on.
The studio's not that big, though.
You're not going to throw it in. So show us your technique, will you? You don't have to get up. I don't want you to injure yourself ahead of some crucial games. Give us a little bit of an insight into the technique of what you do that maybe I can't do, or anybody else who plays football can't do.
Well, basically, when you put your arms behind your back, normal people's elbows will come outside to throw the ball in. Whereas when I do it, when I'm in full motion and stuff, my elbows are quite tight, tucked to my back, to my head. And as the ball swings back, obviously my back will hyperextend as well in the opposite direction to then propel as I run. So I think, to be fair, the running motion and the technique behind that also will get the ball the distance that it goes. But being able to get the trajectory right helps massively.
When did you discover then about the hyperextension and the benefit of that might have to your game?
It's a benefit, but it can also lead to serious injuries, which unfortunately I've had quite a few of.
Because obviously
your
connected?
Joints, your joints are more mobile than others. So your flexibility and laxity within your joints is probably of a higher level than of a normal athlete. But for me, trajectory-wise, I think, just as I grew up, it got longer. It wasn't something that I ever practiced until I went to Florida State, where they had me throwing a med ball in and for a few times. And then I would drop the med ball and throw the ball, and it would all of a sudden go a lot further because I guess you're taking the weight out of it. So naturally, it's like you're preparing yourself for it to go further. But I've never actually sat down and thought, how on earth can I do this? It's just something that I've always had.
Because I was wondering about the year you had at Liverpool, where they had a throw-in coach.
Yeah.
Did you spend much time with him?
I met Thomas when towards the back end of my second season at Liverpool. He was working with obviously Liverpool men's team, and they had worked a lot on Andy Robertson and Alexander-Arnold, doing a lot of work with their throw-ins. And to be fair, he said he had worked that much with them that they had gained a good few metres within their throws. And obviously the amount of times that you actually throw the ball within a football match, statistically wise, you don't really think about it, but there's quite a lot of throw-ins and you can gain a lot of advantage with using them both defensively and attackingly. And so I just sat down with him and worked on maybe a few tips that I could take into my game and things like that, like whether that's switching the point of attack, whether it's defensively or attackingly as well as balls to feet. I probably struggle a lot more with throwing the ball short than I do obviously long. Also then knowing where your teammates are going to be in terms of where you're thrown to, the area you're thrown to, the angle of trajectory, how quick, how slow. Like there's loads of the clogs that turn in your head as you're thinking about where I'm going to throw it next.
So how much time would you spend every week in terms of both the club and when you're in with the country working on throw-ins, working on that positioning of everybody?
When you get to camp, probably we will talk about it in terms of set pieces and stuff, because, I mean, ultimately we've got very tall players, and when we have set plays, it's an asset for us to use. So we want to make the most of that. So yeah, there will be times within meeting towards closer to the game where we'll go through some stuff as to what we can work on, and then in training you'll do it, whether that's at the start, at the end of training, when you're working on set pieces behind closed doors. It's like, how can we get the most out of this? So it's definitely something we work on, but not on the regular.
Because you play as a defender, and often in an attacking sense, you're, if you look at Ireland, you're looking for a Louise Quinn, you know, a defender as well. But looking at it from the other angle as to the difference defending a throw-in than a corner kick, I'm sure people, you're sick of the Rory Delap comparison, but there was that famous clip where they're putting the ball out for a corner kick instead of stopping it for a throw-in because they're easier to defend. Looking at it from a defender's point of view then, as to what the chaos you're trying to cause, what is it, just the trajectory of the ball, the different pace it comes in at, that makes it feel so different to a corner kick or a free kick?
Yeah, definitely. I think the pace is a massive thing. I've spoken to many teammates who have played with and against me throughout the league in England and in Ireland as well, and they've said it's so hard to deal with defensively. When you're on your team, it's easy because you're looking at it from your side, but when you're defending it, it comes in at such a fast pace that it's like near impossible for you to judge where it's going to end up. And sometimes it looks like it's coming shorter and then it'll end up going longer, and obviously vice versa. And so I think for the likes of a corner to a throw-in, a corner will, for the most part, come in a lot more lofted. And I think if I can get it right with a throw-in, it comes in a lot flatter, which makes it unpredictable. Yeah, so any little tiny touch, flick off a defender or an attacker, and it's heading towards a goal, hopefully.
What's the longest you've ever thrown the ball?
I've never recorded it, minus ITV doing it on their clip. And I'd done it with Thomas in the indoor in Liverpool Academy, and it was 35 metres, I think. But obviously when you've got the adrenaline, you've got the crowd behind you in the Aviva like we did, and hopefully again against Sweden, it can really help add those metres to the throw-in.
It's funny you say about the short throws. I was laughing at one stage when, again, you were lining up in that game against England and everybody's waiting and Katie McCabe comes short for you. You're like, what are you doing? Don't be throwing it short. But actually, again, the confusion that you're causing, they'd switched off completely. That actually you're giving it to such, you know, a brilliantly talented player as well, who suddenly has all the space in the world. So
it's
such a weapon. The Aviva did feel a bit special, and it was a time in the game where you come on, there's a throw-in straight away, and it did seem to change the course of the game completely. It brought the energy level of the stadium up. It added a bit of a wild card factor to everything that was happening. Like, what does that feel like?
Yeah, it was... it's hard to describe. I mean, I've never played in the Aviva up until that point, and for me to run onto the field, for one, was an incredible achievement. Two, to hear the crowd behind you for those last 20-25 minutes. And I think we really put it to England, especially for those last 20-25 minutes. And they struggled at times. And it was a credit to ourselves and the team and the staff and the preparation that we had used going into that game. But I think from a throw-in point of view, it just caused chaos. And I don't think they were expecting it. The crowd, I think a lot of them probably hadn't seen it before, because you could hear the woos or the like, what is going on here? And then you see all the phones coming out and people recording. And I think, for me, it was just about getting the crowd up and getting the crowd behind us. And it's not nice for an opponent when you're coming into any stadium and you've got 11 players on the pitch against you, but you've also got 30-odd thousand in the stand who aren't really for you either. So it was just about us trying to create that chaos and try and get chances from it. And we did get a few, and hopefully next time against Sweden we'll put a few closer in and around the goal. But it's chaos, and it's nice to be on our end of it rather than the other.
I can understand why you're a little bit conflicted about it, in terms of this is what so many people know you for, but actually you've had this great long career with the Republic of Ireland where there's been so much more to your game. The injuries you touched upon, like, you've had horrendous luck, and even the fact, you know, you made your debut back in 2011. Touch wood, the end of it. You know, what are you at caps-wise now?
It'll be 50, close to 50.
Which, you know, you probably should have been a 50 many, many years ago. The World Cup injury, having come back from, you know, really serious knee injury, it looked as though you were becoming such a key part of what Vera Powell was trying to do. How do you get that news? How do you deal with that news?
I struggled for a long time, I'm not going to lie. I think it was... it wasn't a major injury either. It was just a flare-up of my knee. But obviously, having previous injuries there, it's deteriorated more than normal. And so if any flare-up happens, sometimes it can be a lot sore, and I just couldn't get it under control, unfortunately. And it started in the April when I was still at Liverpool, and I just couldn't manage it, and I couldn't get the pain to a state where I was able to control it or feel like I could still play on, train on. And I would go 3-4 weeks off, train again, 2 weeks on the last day, going into the third week, it would flare up again. And I just couldn't, there was nothing I could do other than rest, complete rest. And you're thinking about fitness, and you think about how can I go to a World Cup when I've not trained or played in a number of weeks. And it's not fair at all for me to take the place of somebody else who could perform and represent our country at the highest level to the best of their ability when I'm not 100%. And it was really hard for me, because I think I went into the camp and the staff and everyone had really worked hard to try and get me to a position to be fit enough to travel. And I probably could have traveled, but not being able to play in maybe the first 2 or 3 games, hoping then you get out of the group stages and possibly be able to be fit then. But it wasn't fair on me, and I would never have been like to have stood in the place of somebody else.
Did you make the decision then, or did Vera make the decision?
I think Vera and the staff and myself, it was a collective kind of decision. Yes, they were the ultimate ones who had to finalise the squad. But I knew what was coming, and I was okay with that in that sense, because, like I said again, I would never want to take the place of somebody else who was fully fit. But that, I'll never forget that conversation, where at the time we were staying in the UCD apartments training, and I got called to Vera's apartment, and the medical staff were in there, and they just sat me down and they said, listen, like, and I knew, but they were like, unfortunately, it's not going to happen. And yeah, it's something that, yeah.
Even still.
Yeah.
Yeah. Makes these games all the more important to get to a European Championship, yeah, where you don't want to be dragging all your family over to Australia anyways. No. That expensive, isn't it? You don't want to be doing all that. You ought to be a lot closer to home. Does, when you're approaching games like this, and when you've had that tough setbacks through the years, is it always in the back of your mind around injuries? Are you at a stage where you're playing free and easy?
Yeah, of course, you're always thinking, what if? But I think if I constantly lived with that daily, those thoughts, then I wouldn't still be playing a game. And I play the game because I love it, ultimately. Mm. And when my body's ready to stop, then I will stop. If I can still push and push as long as I can, and I feel good enough to do so and still physically fit and mentally fit too, because I think that's a massive part of it when you have had injuries, is the mental aspect. People see the physical side, and for me, I always say the physical side is the easy part, because I'm an athlete, I like to exercise. Yeah. So it's easy to do so, but when you're actually taking a step back, and the mental side of it is the hardest, because you don't see that on the daily, and you don't talk to people, or you're away from family and friends, or your sacrifices that you make and the things you miss out on is really tough. And I think some people might not see that side, you know, the fans looking in. Obviously, I would always have my family. They're there, whether over a phone call or they fly in or I fly home. Then I've also got my partner and her family back home as well. So I have people around me, which I care a lot about. And obviously then you've got your teammates too at club and country, who are always dropping messages in to, like, if you're ever struggling or whatever. But I think from a psychologist's point of view, I think it's so important that players aren't afraid to say that they've sought advice, or, you know, took a step back when things were going tough and spoke to somebody, because ultimately that's how you get the best out of yourself, is being able to live with a clear mind. And for players especially, because they go through a lot of stress on the daily, and the expectations are so high when you're playing at the highest level. So yeah, to not be afraid to seek advice was something that I struggled with a long time too, because you don't want to show that weakness, or it's not weakness, but it's the thought of it being weak or looking weak, and it's definitely not. I think it's actually, when you finally do it, you feel a weight off your shoulders, and that stress has gone away, and it's actually the strongest possible thing you could do, is to step up and go, actually, I need help, or I need to speak to someone. And when I did so over the summer, after I didn't make the World Cup, Liverpool were really good with me in terms of offering that that support to me, and I spoke to a guy for a number of months to really get me back to feeling healthy again and feeling good again. So I'm really glad I'm in the position I'm in right now, and I'm feeling good and I'm healthy and fit, and yeah, looking forward to what's next. But to be able to say I've played for possibly my country almost 50 times is, yeah, it's a credit to my family, my friends, and the people who have got me, coaches, and all those people who've got me to the place I am today. So
yeah, because we did the show in the Mansion House with the team the night they were leaving, and the squad had just been announced that morning. It was a very surreal atmosphere because you could see the impact it had on the players who were going, the players who weren't going, and that bit of like, do you leave the WhatsApp group? Do you just leave the players alone? Do you want to be a positive support, but sometimes it's just bloody hard.
Yeah, to be fair, I think in the background you've probably go through those emotions yourself, but for the most part, I was supporting the team, was supporting the team 100%, and I wanted them to do so well, and watching every game and cheering the girls on and messaging the girls and wishing them all the best. And I truly meant it, because I really wanted the team to go there and perform as how we had done in the previous years leading up to that campaign. And it wasn't just for the players that were there, it was for the players who had came before, because we wouldn't be in a position to be able to qualify for major tournaments if it wasn't for those Emma Burns, Kira Grant, Yvonne Tracy's, you know. You've got so many players, Olivia O'Toole, who, and the first ever original set of players who had come through, and you know, without those foundations we wouldn't have the ability and the honour of representing our country on the biggest stage. So I was definitely rooting for the team and wishing them well, and I think they really gave a good account of themselves out there at the World Cup.
But you're back, and it's still an incredibly exciting time getting that first appearance at the Aviva, hopefully another one to come. Yeah. Next week against Sweden, there's going to be a trip to Porquicuive, it looks like, as well, for the match against France. This group and the group you've been drawn into, obviously incredibly difficult, and I know we want to test ourselves against the best. Sometimes you just want a bit of a break as well. Yeah. Sweden, like the games in the World Cup qualification campaign, you know, Morden knew what they were about and able to go toe-to-toe with them. Are these the two games, as much as any, where actually you feel, we can go and get something?
You could look at it that way, but I also think we have to take every game where we can go into it getting a result. And I think we did put up a very good performance against England. I think in parts we gave up a very good performance against France. So we have to be clever and honest in how we are compared to these teams and where we are in relation to that as well. And they're not European champions. They're not going to the Olympics and, you know, being number 1, 2, 3, 4 in the world for no reason. You know, these are great teams, and we want to test ourselves against the best because we want to be there one day. Whether that's something that we would like to do now or later on, it's happening. When you get to the Euros, you got to play the best teams anyway. So for us, it's about finishing as high as we can in this group and giving ourselves the best opportunity to make it to the Euros in next year in Switzerland. So yes, I think playing against Sweden not so long ago will obviously give us a bit more confidence going into these two games. We've got a lot of footage on them. We've got a lot of players that we know personally how they play and things like that. But we will be focused on ourselves and how we can come into the game and best apply ourselves against Sweden.
Well, listen, very best of luck with the upcoming couple of matches and, of course, the games as the summer goes on. Everyone will be off their feet at the Aviva once again once that first throwing comes when you're on the pitch, and you'll be ready for it. You'll know all the cameras will be out. You can give them a little wave and all that. But thanks so much for coming in, Megan. And look, we'll talk to you over the coming months.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.